Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, what does it mean to be an agent of change?
We are going to grow, and we are going to make mistakes, and we're going to take risks.
That's today on Inflection Point. Stay tuned. In 1996, WNYC was a New York City-owned radio station reaching about 1 million people. Under Laura Walker's leadership, WNYC has been described as being on innovation overdrive, and it's become a multimedia group called New York Public Radio, reaching more than 18 million people. It now encompasses multiple radio stations in New York and New Jersey, and even a performance space, offering up award-winning journalism and expanding to include a national podcast network. I spoke with Laura to find out what drives her and how she keeps it growing. Thanks for joining me today, Laura.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You just celebrated your 20-year anniversary at New York Public Radio. Congratulations.
Thank you.
In that time, you've grown from serving about 1 million people to about 18 million people. That's almost like a million people a year, actually. How big do you want to take this?
Well, I don't exactly think of it that way, but I actually think we're actually higher than that even now. But, you know, it's been so interesting to take the station from kind of local public radio that was owned by the city of New York to an independent nonprofit that is serving the country with digital podcasts and national radio shows and also a really strong newsroom that covers issues here in New York. And I think there's a real thirst, as I think you probably know as well, for great story and powerful journalism in the audio format, because now, you know, you can take it anywhere you are, you want, and you can have your mobile devices and take them here in New York on the subway or on the street or in the car. And I think there's so many people that are thirsting for great stories and great audio. And so I think we've only just begun.
Well, it is so interesting that a station that started off as a city station really is becoming a national entity, or international, global, really. I mean, with the technology, you really could be anywhere outside of a cab. Do you think there will ever be a time when you can say, you know, we're good here, we did this, we're done?
Well, it's kind of not in my DNA, nor in the DNA of most people here, because I think part of our creative spirit is to always be searching for the next story and always be looking for how can we be better and how can we innovate in the format and find new people to talk with or to feature. So it's like any creative endeavor. You're just never done. You're always looking for the story of tomorrow is different than the story of today. And so our role is to tell the powerful stories. And there are also, it's a fascinating time because there are so many other journalists and individuals and organizations that want to partner to create podcasts and audio. So, you know, for example, we just launched the New Yorker Radio Hour. And, you know, that's a great collaboration. It's also a terrific way that the New Yorker is experimenting in this medium. And I think there's going to be many more incredibly creative people. And, you know, it's such a privilege to work with David Remnick at the New Yorker and the incredible writers and you know, the artists and everyone at the New Yorker. And so that just expands us. You know, it expands the sense of possibility. You know, there are, as I think you may know, not as many women's voices on podcasts as we think there should be. You know, I've set a goal to try to get to 50% of the top 100 to be women's voices. So, you know, hopefully you can get there. And we have several women in the top 100. And it's what's so exciting is there's so many people discovering the audio medium. And really, it is kind of limitless, I think, in possibility.
Well, and it's also interesting, the crossover medium. So taking a print publication like The New Yorker and bringing it in to the world of audio. And I know that you got your start as a print journalist.
Yes.
So in a typical week, how does Laura Walker, the journalist, or even thinking as a, in terms of being a print journalist, inform Laura Walker, the CEO of New York Public Radio?
Well, you know, I think that the training you get as a journalist, whether print or audio or whatever, is to ask probing questions and to, in some ways, never be satisfied, to, you know, search for the truth, to not be led by somebody's answers, but to kind of probe a little more deeply. So as an example, even though I'm not reporting anymore, I'm far from it, I certainly use my journalism experience to, when I'm listening to podcasts and listening to pieces and assessing them. So listening to this incredible piece on Only Human about this African-American doctor who lived down south and who he's an obstetrician who started his career not performing abortions. And after listening, I think, to Martin Luther King's speech, he changed his mind. And it's an incredibly powerful piece. And so I use my journalism skills to appreciate that kind of thing from both. I certainly appreciate it as a human being who's touched by the story, but also by looking at the craft that's involved. I use it when, for example, I was talking to our board about the editorial guidelines that we have and why we don't let anyone, you know, take political positions or be at rallies or whatever. And that's very much informed by the journalistic principles and traditions that I was taught. I think there's always, you know, when you look at kind of what should we be covering? Even today, you know, we're sitting in New York. This huge crane just fell down several blocks south of our office. And, you know, it's the journalist in me that's, okay, are we down there? You know, are we covering it? You know, that never goes away.
That's actually a great segue to this next question, which is, as someone who lives and breathes radio and journalism, is it possible for you to listen to programming and just simply enjoy it without feeling like, did we cover it? You know, how good a job did we do?
Yeah. You know, it's really an interesting question. I spent a fair amount of time, or 2 years, actually, it wasn't that long. When I was in my 20s, I worked at Carnegie Hall and I produced a radio show and we recorded all these concerts. I found it impossible to go to a concert without worrying about, like, how was it mic'd or, you know, was the live broadcast going well, even though obviously there was no live broadcast I was, you know, concerned with for several. I just couldn't go for 2 years. And then because there was too much worry about that. And now I can really enjoy a concert again.
You've got no
But, you know, trauma. And it was like, how long is that? And what's that encore? And, you know, all that. I don't actually have that feeling about I really can enjoy podcasts, and I do think about it from a craft perspective. Like, I was just listening to the Serial update on my way to work, you know, Sarah Koenig, you know, covering the hearing of Adnan's request for another trial. And yeah, I was like, wow, that's pretty cool the way she's doing that. But I appreciate it more. I don't find myself kind of analyzing it that much. I just appreciate it.
When you became head of WNYC, you were in your late 30s. I'm curious, how did you establish authority at that time? Coming in, it was the mid-90s. You're relatively young as a CEO. You were a woman, which is also unusual for that position. How did you establish authority coming in like that?
I tried to use the opportunity, which existed very much, very strongly, to reinvent the stations, because it was a moment in time when everything was changing, because we were becoming independent from the city. That had been preordained by the time I walked in the door. I was the agent of change. And there was a beleaguered crew, because they had been, you know, the city had basically said they were going to sell these stations. So people were worried about their jobs. They were worried about whether public radio would exist in New York, like literally whether it would be there. So I had an opportunity to both make sure that people felt secure in kind of the fact that public radio would be there, but also to build an excitement about the future and to ask a lot of questions. I think I tried very hard to not come in feeling like I knew more than other people. At the same time, I did have to establish my authority, so I set out processes for when we were going to be making decisions around, you know, how we were going to grow. I remember very, very distinctly when I came down to talk to the staff, before I even started, it was after I had my appointment had been announced, and I said something like, we are going to grow, and we are going to make mistakes, and we're going to take risks. And those three things, growing, risk-taking, and making mistakes and learning from them, I think have been a hallmark of what I've tried to do. And so I think, you know, if, and I also, I think because I was a producer, I had been a radio producer, and I'd spent many years in the trenches editing, and I really appreciated truly, I think, you know, the work that people did. And I think people, I think, understood that. Right now, I think probably most of the staff doesn't even know that I was a producer. I should remind them.
Excuse me, I'm going to take this one from here.
Yeah. Except this is really hard. This is really embarrassing, but I cut with a razor blade.
Oh, I think they got rid of all those.
Yeah, I know they did, right? I know how to do it, but not as well.
Well, the growing, it seems that you're continuing on that trend, the risk-taking and probably making mistakes. With the, you know, with the size that you are now and with all of the initiatives that you've got before you, how do you keep track of all these moving parts and ensure that they're delivering on your vision?
You hire great people and you set clear metrics and you celebrate the successes and try to learn from the mistakes.
I want to know how you don't burn out. <You've> got, you sound incredibly busy, incredibly driven, and it sounds like you're building a great team, but how do you keep all the balls in the air and keep yourself sane?
You hire a great staff.
You take risks.
You take risks. Honestly, I think it is truly about the staff. It's about the board. It's a board of people who want. This was the board that stood up to the mayor and said very boldly, "We are going to buy these stations because public radio not only has to exist, but it has to thrive." And that spirit of, we're not here just to kind of survive. We're here to have more impact and be able to and to be leaders, not only in this city, but in this country. And my board of trustees believes that with all their DNA. And so they're here to support me. And they're also here to be strategy partners with me. And so they're both supportive, but they also are intellectually and creatively they're risk takers themselves, and they support me and push me, and then I think also, frankly, I have a fabulous husband and at home, and you know, I have two kids who continue to be awesome. So I had an experience earlier this week. I have a 24-year-old and a 16-year-old, and my 24-year-old came in. He asked me if he could shadow me for a day, and it was so much fun. Mix my worlds.
Yeah, bring your kid to work day. Except he's an adult kid,
and he really wanted to be here, as opposed to bring your kid to work day and they color in the
right.
In the studio.
So, did he have any observations after that? Did you talk about it?
Yeah, he did. Now, he is graduated from college and he's living in Durham, North Carolina. He is starting a nonprofit magazine, actually. So he, I think, was thinking a lot about leadership and about how to kind of set the direction for the next phase of his magazine. But he said a couple things. He said, it is amazing. He went to the board. We actually had a board meeting that day. And he said, your board was really, really involved. And he said, I was surprised that it was so informal. And he said something like, we were presenting a plan for a new initiative. And he said, you know, you talk about these ideas at home, but boy, there's a lot of thought that goes into them. I thought that was, it's like, I get it now. I mean, like, is there that much thought about everything? I said, yeah, kind of. So he was pretty impressed. And then he said he thought that the people he met here, the staff, that they were, you know, they really enjoyed one another and they enjoyed being here, and that there was a style that was fluid and informal again, but also always kind of getting to an objective. And that I love that.
Well, why is this work so important to you?
In some ways, it is very much who I am. I am a journalist. I am someone who loves music. And I believe in my heart that public radio is, our mission is more important than it ever has been. Even as there are more and more information outlets, I think having nonprofit media that is dedicated not to the clicks, but dedicated to telling the story, that there is a place where people can come together, you know, around a trusted source. I love to be part of an environment and watch these incredibly talented people find innovative ways to push the next kind of generation of radio. So, like, for instance, we're doing all these engagement projects like InfoMagical, which we're doing this week, which is kind of a way that I think 26,000 people are signed up to try different exercises every day about how they can kind of detox and focus their lives more and have more clarity. And that's a really interesting new development in the way radio is. So I just love the constant creativity, and I love the journalism, and I really think it's so important.
So InfoMagical is part of the Note to Self podcast that I have heard, and I have heard that you've taken some of the exercises from, things like put your cell phone in your purse and don't look at it on your ride
right.
to work, right? That
exactly,
those kinds of tips.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
So is this part of the expanded health coverage that WNYC is offering? Is it part of that
it's
initiative?
It's actually not exactly part of the health coverage. Only Human is, that's the one where the doctor talked about the abortion. They did an engagement project they have been doing one, the health project. Only Human has been doing one with Dan Ariely, who's a behavioral scientist down at Duke. And they've been, I think they have about 15,000 people participating. Is that right? I think they have about 15,000 people participating, and they are basically studying people as they stick to their resolutions and or not. And it's a real experiment that Dan is going to use the data from to see what kind of prompts worked and what don't. I'm doing that one, too. I'm trying to stick to my exercise routine.
Well, I had read, the reason I was asking about the healthcare coverage is that I had read that one of the driving forces behind WNYC's expanded coverage of healthcare in the past year was personal events in your life. And I was just wondering if you would be willing to talk about that.
Sure. My son, Evan, who is the one that was visiting and shadowing me, had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that obviously is a parent's nightmare. It was a very scary 6 to 10 months. It changed my perspective in many ways about certainly the fragility of it all. Even though, you know, he's fine, he's healthy, he's very optimistic and I think more mature kid in some ways, or young man at this point. But I came out of that feeling boy, I had no idea myself before I went through that, you know, how chemo worked. I had no idea about all of the kind of medical research that was happening that was so interesting. In fact, you know, Evan, when he was with me the other day, we had lunch with a friend, and I had forgotten that there was this connection, but this is a friend who has a kind of lymphoma, and he had pills in his pocket. You know, this was the new kind of chemo. It was it was by pill, and it's part of a trial, and it's, you know, it's so interesting to know that there's so much possibility of, you know, treating cancer, and I think that, you know, there's, you realize when you go through something like that, that the structure of the health system matters a lot. We were very lucky to have great health insurance, and we were incredibly lucky to be at Sloan Kettering where there was like a team approach. But I also became very aware that not everyone has that, and that, you know, the structure of our health care system, which I think is 18% of the GDP of this country, is in dire need of new thinking. And I think also from the point of view of just you realize that some things are in your control and some things aren't. And you want to be able to have the information to control what you can control, like exercising and getting sleep. And so we set out to try to figure out, how do we motivate people to make good choices in their lives? How do we cover the science advances in medical research, and so much of which is happening here and in your city too? And how do we look at the structure and the economics of the healthcare system and figure out how we're going to change it?
Well, I'm sure that sharing all of that information resonates so much with audiences who, you know, who are either trying to be proactive about their health or have never had to even think about what to do if one of their loved ones gets sick until they're actually in it. You know, it's almost this dark side of the moon until you got to travel there.
That's right. And it's, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that Evan did when he was sick was go back to the poetry that he learned from Marty.
Oh.
and write again.
The poetry he learned again.
In high school. And that love of poetry and that sense that poetry is a way to kind of not just express your own feelings, but also to make connections.
Oh, will he be publishing any of it in his new magazine?
I don't, you know, he's very much about, maybe he's my son, he's very much about putting other people's work out there. He hasn't used this as a vehicle to publish his own work, even though he's quite talented.
Well, let's talk about the Women's Voices Initiative. From what I understand, it's designed to promote and bring more women into podcasting. You mentioned the goal of 50%. Why do you feel like it's important in podcasting over traditional broadcast?
Because I think we're at the beginning of it. And I want to see this medium be the first medium to get to 50% of any medium. It took a long time. We're not even there. Obviously, you look at the Academy Awards. We are so far from being there in other media. Julie Shapiro did a study in 2013. So, and she looked at the top 100 podcasts. And if I have the numbers right, I think 80% were all men. About 11% were men and women. And the other 9% were women alone. As the hosts of the podcast. And I thought, this cannot be. We have to change this. So, you know, I was on a panel, actually, with Pat Harrison of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and we were talking about what we wanted to talk about. And I was kind of really upset about this study, and I said, we need to do something. Pat, will you join me in, you know, kind of making a commitment to try to increase the number of women's voices in podcasts? And she said yes, and so basically on the panel announced that she would help support an initiative. And we did, you know, we funded things like Death, Sex, and Money and Note to Self, and with incredibly talented women, Anna Sale of Death, Sex, and Money, and Manusha Marodi, and a few other ones that we're now working on. And we held this Women's Podcasting Festival here in our performance space. And I think 250 women came from for-profit, not-for-profit, people who were who had podcasts, some who were dreaming of podcasts, and it was just It was fabulous. It was so supportive. It was so intelligent. And I was just so thrilled and touched to see this incredible interest. And I also think it's something, you know, look, I think a lot of us like to talk.
We're good at it.
We're good at it. So it's a good medium for us.
Right. Well, it is. It's kind of like a scientific experiment in a way to see what happens in nature, right, where it's a new medium. It's dominated by men. And it takes somebody to decide that we need more women and then to create a space for them as opposed to it just happening naturally. What do you think about that?
I knew when I walked into that Women's Podcast Festival that it's really like you put a fire and there's a spark and then it all happens on its own. So I think you have to both create the space and then you have to go out and support those that are there, you know. And so we also had this experience at the podcast festival that we had Jessica Williams did something. She's with The Daily Show.
Yep.
We just loved her. And it turns out that she does this live show in Brooklyn with Phoebe Robinson called Two Dope Queens. And we are making a podcast out of it. And so these are two incredibly talented, just funny and natural young women. And when you look, you find it.
Laura, I heard on one of the WNYC podcasts that was featuring, it was kind of a recap of the, or maybe it was a pregame for the final season of Mad Men, that your dad was an advertising man in the 60s.
Yes.
Okay. This is a true statement.
It is a true statement. Right?
So what was it like growing up with a madman?
Well, you know, he didn't live, unfortunately, to see Mad Men. But I did ask my mother, was this what it was really like? And she just smiled and laughed a little. My dad, I don't think, was quite as crazy as these guys. But, you know, we actually lived like Don Draper up the Hudson in Tarrytown, New York, you know. And I think it was the place where a lot of kind of creative young college graduates who had been in the war, which was my dad, right? He was in World War II. He actually played clarinet in the band. He's on the creative side. He went to Columbia and then he came out and his first job was at the Gallup poll to, you know, going around door to door asking questions. But he spent a fair amount of time in ad agencies and then I think he was 13 years at NBC, actually, doing sales. So he was on the other side. But yes, they did have a lot of martinis for lunch, I think.
Right. How did anyone get any work done?
I have no idea. And I wish I could ask him. But fortunately, he and my mother had a lovely relationship and stayed together. So that it wasn't that way, like Mad Men. And actually, my love of radio comes from him because he listened to jazz a lot. And there was this incredible jazz station at Riverside Church, WRVR. We used to listen to classical music on WKCR, the Columbia station, and WQXR. And so I have very fond memories of listening with my dad. And he was so excited when NPR, was started, and was just thrilled that when I worked there for a while, and proud when I took this job.
I heard through the grapevine, let's put it that way, that he might have actually been involved in rescuing the station
yes.
from a fire?
No, he was involved trying to save WRVR, which was owned by Riverside Church, where we were members. So the church was selling it because it needed the money, and he was one of the lone people who wanted to save it. He didn't win. He did not prevail. But he used to take me on Sundays. We would go and look in the window to the studio. So I remember that as a kid.
Laura, what's the best advice that you've ever gotten about keeping a vision intact?
Some of the best advice has been, as the head of the organization, you have to be the one looking the longest out. And you have to keep your eye on where you're going. And that sounds easy, but it isn't always, because you can get so distracted by the day-to-day, which of course is important, but you're really, as the leader of the organization, the only one that can, you know, kind of be looking at where are we going. And the another piece related to that is that, for me, somebody said to me, every 5 years, you should either basically reinvent the organization and reinvent your job so you have a new job, or leave. And so I do that every 5 years. As we do a new strategic plan, I really go through a process of kind of, you know, where are we going? And is this exciting? Am I the right person to lead this? And so far, I've said to myself, and the board has said yes. But, you know, it's very much of, like, it's a new job. It's really exciting. Now let's go. So I'm incredibly privileged.
Well, Laura Walker, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Laura Walker, the president and CEO of New York Public Radio. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, like Gina Harmon and Gabe and Mart, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.